Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Max Verstappen beats Fernando Alonso to victory at the Monaco Grand Prix despite a late rain shower offering Aston Martin a redemption chance. This is the F1 Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato and this is Round 6, the Monaco Grand Prix. The streets of Monte Carlo were billed as perhaps the best chance of the season for a car not plastered with Red Bull stickers to take the chequered flag. The reason for optimism was that the RB19 is comparatively weaker in qualifying than in racing conditions, and Monaco wouldn't give it a chance to flex its usual strengths. But Verstappen went all out for a precious pole position in an electrifying qualifying session, setting himself up for victory ahead of the front row starter Fernando Alonso. Though rain arrived late to give Alonso a chance to take an unlikely lead, Aston Martin played things safe, taking a season-best second, but allowing Verstappen to claim his fourth win of the year. To talk us through the Monaco Grand Prix, and the Monaco Grand Prix that could have been had things gone only slightly differently, I'm joined by Ed Straw from The Race, and of course the host of The Race F1 Podcast. Ed, how you doing?
Yeah, great. Thanks very much for inviting me on and getting the plug-in for me so I don't have to hopelessly sell my own podcast. But yeah, great to join you, even though, as I said when you mentioned you might invite me on for this podcast, it feels like a bit of a hospital pass getting Monaco on a podcast called Strategy Report. But actually, it served up something quite interesting.
Thank goodness. That was probably the smoothest intro. The intro is probably the smoothest thing that's happened in Monaco all weekend, though, considering the way the whole place runs and the Grand Prix is going on. The best thing about this podcast is that we don't have to get stuck in traffic on the way to it. I think everyone who was in Monaco would agree anyway. The build-up for this race, Ed, was about it being potentially the best chance a non-Red Bull racing team might have to win, and principally because it might be the best chance a non-Red Bull racing team might have to get pole position. Red Bull is not at its strongest in qualifying, and this is such an unusual track that the thinking was that this might present some opportunities. In the end, we did get a pretty close qualifying, and for a lot of the race, it seemed like it was sort of up for grabs. We'll get into that as we go, of course. But what is it about this circuit that made Red Bull appear, and I'm careful to use the word vulnerable, but relatively vulnerable compared to what we've seen so far this year?
Yeah, very much so. Well, throughout the year, as you alluded to, there's been this pattern of it being much closer in qualifying, and then the race advantage is massive, and they had a race pace advantage here as well. But it was always about the track configuration, the fact that it's getting those front tyres up to temperature. That's been the thing that's contained them a little bit in qualifying. And obviously, this is a relatively low energy circuit in terms of warming those up. You also had the fact that with the C5s that were the qualifying tyre here, they basically only gave you one lap. So you had to get them warmed up on the out lap, make it work. You couldn't necessarily even do the second preparation lap because of the way the traffic worked and because of the way the tyre behaved. So that was an extra challenge for them, the fact they couldn't just do push, cool, push all the time and get the best out of it. It had to be right out you go, bang. So they knew that was going to be tricky in terms of Red Bull's perspective, and the others knew there was a chance there. So for me, this race was always about, can somebody out-qualify a Red Bull? Very possible. And then if they can, this being Monaco, you should be able to stay there because you're containing their race pace. So yeah, there was, I will admit, there was a hope that it happened simply because it's good to see variety. And also there was a tantalizing possibility if Verstappen was behind, he might have to try and pull off an overtake, which isn't completely impossible with a race pace advantage. Difficult, but that would have been interesting as well. But yeah, we didn't quite get it. So yeah, Verstappen knew how difficult it was going to be. And that's, I think, why he was so delighted with that pole lap when he got it at the end, just ahead of Fernando Alonso.
I'm interested to know what you think of that pole lap, because some have said, well, what are the greatest laps, or at least greatest third sector? On the other hand, you could argue he was in the walls a lot in that sector. Obviously, the car survived just fine, so I suppose credit to him. What did you make of the way he set that lap? And of course, the strategy he took into qualifying of the team took preparing the tyres. He was one of the few drivers who got three runs in. It was the very last one that ultimately did it for him.
Yeah, they obviously knew they needed to throw everything at it, try and get the absolute most out of it. And also, you always know there's going to be yellow flags and red flags and that kind of thing in Monaco qualifying at some point. Surprisingly, there wasn't anything at the end. So they knew they had to be absolutely on it to do it. And it was an interesting performance profile across the lap, because the Aston Martin was very strong in the hands of Alonso in the first two sectors, not so good in the third sector. And the Red Bull was an absolute rocket ship in the third sector there through Raskas, the last corner. So it was an interesting situation, because you had Verstappen knowing that almost the back end of the lap was going to be absolutely key for him, and Alonso, who knew the first part was. So Alonso obviously went first, and he did two really good sectors. And he then thought, right, we'll get through the third sector as best you can. He actually sacrificed a tiny bit at the chicane to try and keep the tyres in a little bit more, to give him that bit of extra bite right at the end of the lap. That trade-off didn't quite work, but I think he was moving the trade-off around and it never quite added up. But Verstappen didn't actually do a brilliant first part of the lap, even relative to his normal pace, but he knew in that last sector he had a shot, and he really, really went for it, leant on it. Obviously, we saw he kissed the wall. So he was very much a wall brushing Monaco extreme lap. And the interesting thing was, part of it is the performance offsets. Obviously, you make up just over 0.2 or whatever it was in the last sector. That's a lot in a 19-second sector. Some of that was in the car, but also some of it was in what Verstappen did. I think he found 0.16 compared to his previous best in that sector, which in a 19-second sector is a huge percentage gain. Alonso found sort of a few hundredths compared to his best. The one thing I do wonder is, did Fernando Alonso look back at that and think, oh, could I have maybe laid it on the line, taken that extra bit of risk at the end of the lap? Because I think he thought probably sectors one and two were about right. So probably Verstappen went that little bit quicker than anyone expected him to, or even maybe Verstappen expected to. So it was just a really, really good setup. And I don't think it was Verstappen's greatest qualifying lap. To be honest, Monaco qualifying laps, they're always a bit imperfect because it's such an imperfect track. That's what makes it so great. But this was a really hard pole for Verstappen to pull off. And I thought he did an absolutely brilliant job balancing up that risk versus rewarding and getting it right, even if it was a little bit of a shame for the race.
Just going back, and we will then come back to this a little bit later on, just to make the segue particularly confusing. You talk about how some percentage, naturally enough, of that time gain was in Verstappen himself, not necessarily considering the car. Esteban Ocon was briefly on pole. He was on provisional pole, qualified third, and we will talk about him finishing third later on. How do you reflect then on a lap like that? Is it true, I suppose, or does it reflect that truism that Monaco does allow the drivers to play a little bit more of an influence just because of the, I guess, daring you need to get as close to the walls? Or is this a little bit of a glimpse that actually we were perhaps wrong to discount Alpine being, well, to a degree in the mix this weekend?
There's a little bit of both. I didn't expect Alpine to be that quick, but it was clearly there in the car. I think the driver can create a little bit more of a swing. I guess you could come up with a notional percentage of what's car and what's driver. I tend to think of it a bit more as a combination, because the car defines the performance potential, the driver extracts it. But certainly, if you have a good hooked up lap with no real mistakes, committed, precise, Ocon's lap actually was really, really good. That one wasn't one that you watch on board and you think, wow, that's really extreme laying it on the line, perhaps as you did a bit with Verstappen. But Ocon's was just beautifully controlled and smooth. He's a lovely driver to watch when he's in that kind of mood and can turn these amazing laps. Perhaps he doesn't do it as often as we might like, but really it was a beautiful one to watch. And I think pretty much the deficit to pole was just what the pace of the car was. So yeah, I think a little bit was in Ocon. A little bit was in the fact there were a few other contenders out the way. So Ocon obviously ended up qualifying third. He was fourth fastest. Leclerc got the penalty. You had Perez out the way. So that helped him as well. But Ocon and Alpine were really on it. In fact, they said that from the start of the weekend, they put the car on the track and it was actually working pretty well. So if you've got a good mechanical package, the driver's confident, Ocon's gone well here before, he's good round here, you can do that. But it was interesting. For Ocon, it was just sort of about piecing it together, and not a car that had sort of extreme pace, but it had good pace. And he just really, really put together the three sectors to be able to leap ahead of a few people who probably had fundamentally quicker cars. It wasn't quite the same as a Verstappen one. I should say, I also really like the Alpine strategy going offset and out of phase. I actually thought Ocon was going to get pole. And in fact, Ocon thought he might, because he was on provisional pole. And clearly, there were cars who were going to go quicker, a bit of track evolution last run. But I would have laid odds, and, you know, barely laid generous odds worth backing on there being a yellow or a red flag in that last run. And of course there wasn't. So Alpine were probably thinking, oh, we've got a chance here. Almost he was favourite for pole because the assumption is someone will crash, someone will have a yellow flag. But yeah, a great job by Alpine. That I think was just a car that was pretty good and certainly not far off the top ones. Still a leading midfielder rather than a front runner, but condensed gaps at Monaco. Really good job by team, really good job by driver, clever strategic thinking as well. Make sure you have clear track and wasn't going to be interfered with by yellow. So yeah, that was one of good execution all round, I would say. The Verstappen one was a bit more interesting because they knew it was always going to be really marginal. So that's why they were having to have that balance of risk versus reward. Or else I don't feel Ocon went into it thinking, right, I'm going to start brushing some walls. I think he did have a few moments, to be fair, as well. Most do around there. But yeah, it's an interesting contrast.
Just before we look at the race and how that was decided, qualifying in Monaco is inevitably the highlight of the weekend because the cars are on low fuel, the drivers are really taking a lot of risk. I shouldn't say inevitably. Sometimes the races are absolute classics, but it is more often than not that we're talking about the climax almost really being Q3 in particular and qualifying in general. In this era in which modern Formula One is willing to experiment with format changes, we know this weekend the drivers have apparently been talking in the driver's briefing about maybe dividing qualifying into heats just to avoid traffic and allow them to kind of perfect their laps. Do you feel like there is a way Formula One should treat Monaco differently? Of course, without detracting from the Grand Prix, which is central to the whole purpose of Formula One, maybe to have qualifying take center stage in a different way. A little bit of an arbitrary question, I suppose, but I can't help but think every time we come to Monaco that it almost feels like qualifying gets forgotten a little bit too quickly considering what we see.
Yeah, it's one of the best qualifying sessions of the year always. Obviously, there's sort of two things there, aren't there? There's the question of, is there a way to do it better? And almost the fact you could make it a special and unusual session comes from the solution to that. Because when drivers were talking about putting it into groups, which is the F2 mm-hmm. methodology, I sort of thought, well, okay, so if you're saying the problem is fundamentally there's traffic, they were talking in particular about Q1 with so many cars on the track and the difficulty of finding space. So you think, okay, let's say it's a problem to have that many cars on track. How do you reduce them? Okay, the split groups is okay, but with the current format, if you were going to do a split group for Q1 and then put 15 cars into Q2, there's a bit of an odd number issue there in terms of you've got 15 cars, so you'd have to take 7 from one and 8 from the other, and unless you do it on pure time, and then there's track evolution. But I was actually thinking, if you say it's a problem and you want to make it a bit more of a focus, you could go with some kind of single lap qualifying format, which I know is perhaps a dangerous suggestion because it was hugely unpopular when it was tried almost 20 years ago now, just short of that. But I think as a one-off, you could say, actually, this is a good way of doing it. And then you come down to, okay, do you want to have one lap for everyone, or do you want to let them have two single lap runs, if that's not a little bit of an odd thing to say? So I would lean towards something like that. I think either you leave it as it is and you accept there's traffic, you accept it's a normal one, or as you suggested, you try and make it into something else. You solve a problem with the cars on track, if that is a problem, and you just have a one-shot qualifying, maybe in free practice order or something, and that creates a little extra shootout at the end of FP3, perhaps as well, where you can have a bit of traffic chaos as well. That's kind of where I was leading, but obviously open to suggestions for if you do want to change things, how to do it. I think either you stick with what you've got or you go pretty extreme.
I think so. I mean, Monaco it has its reputation in the calendar. There's no reason why it can't be treated a little bit differently as well in that case. And I think that, you know, if we're going to have some number of sprints, for example, if the goal isn't, as Stefano Domenicali has now said, to have every race a sprint, then there shouldn't be any problem with having Monaco as a non-continuous format that we don't see anywhere else, given that, well, we might get to a stage where the calendar is just variable in the way we go racing. But maybe a bigger question for another day. At least we do still get qualifying, and that is still a highlight.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
We did have this specter, though, of a little bit of race tension, in fact, in this Grand Prix. And then, well, really all hell broke loose in the last third of the race. But to set us up from the start, Fernando Alonso said even after qualifying, he didn't think there was any realistic prospect of him getting Verstappen off the line unless Verstappen had a particularly bad start, which you can, I mean, it's up to you whether you want to bet on that. Probably less likely than more likely. So he started on the hard tyre, which was, I suppose, really a gamble that something would happen later in the race, which fortunately enough it did, although perhaps not in the way they would have expected with safety cars or crashes or red flags.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice, the starting tyre, because it obviously gives you the different grip levels at the start. So I think it was always pretty inevitable Verstappen would start on mediums, because there's an argument for starting on hards, particularly if you know there might be rain around, as there was talk about that. So the appeal of being on hards and being able to run to the rain is quite an appealing one as an option. But of course, if Verstappen had put on hards and then Alonso turned up on mediums or something, you'd think, okay, that's going to give him a bit of ground at the start. It is hard to jump someone at the start of Monaco, very hard, but you don't want to give them an extra possibility. So yeah, it created a very interesting scenario. And of course, you had Verstappen there while he was leading, saying, look, these tyres aren't going well, because the deg wasn't great on the mediums for a number of runners. So yeah, it created that interesting tension there. I suspect Aston Martin felt it was a little bit of a gamble. They were probably pretty confident Ocon was going to hold up people behind as well. So as we did see in the race, it made it a two-horse race up at the front. So they've had that in mind as well. We don't have to worry too much about that, provided we stay ahead of Ocon. And it just creates a bit of variety, because at least if you've got an offset, some kind of difference, you can try and do something. You can even do the thing of running a bit longer, and Verstappen could have pitted and a safety car or a virtual safety car come out and Alonso might have jumped him. So it opens up possibilities for that little bit of luck to happen, even though it doesn't give you an obvious window where you will be quicker, shall we say. So you're just saying, right, we're not going to lock ourselves into following what you're doing. We're going to make you think about what you're doing by having the extra range, and then you get to make the move, which is not actually what happened in the end because of the rain, but it's all about setting up those possible offsets and those possible opportunities. And I quite like the fact they went with the hard for the start for Alonso. I think it made a lot of sense.
It's an understated move, I think, in Monaco in particular, to make sure the ball is in the court of the leader. Ordinarily, that sounds like a silly thing, but considering there's so much to lose in Monaco and track position is everything, forcing the leader into making the first decision can sometimes actually be a pretty good move. And that seems like we were going towards. The rain did arrive. We saw rain, or rain was on the long-term forecast, then it wasn't, and then we got to the race start and it started to look a bit grey. Long story short is, by around about lap 50, it started to become clear that we're probably going to get a little bit of rain. We just didn't know how much it was going to be. Headed towards the mid-50s and the rain was coming down. It was quite wet in parts of the track. Verstappen wasn't pitting. He'd done really quite a good job to stick out on those mediums. As you said, they were complaining of graining and several drivers had already moved off them. But knowing the rain was in the air and Alonso was ready to pounce, was essentially forced to stay out on them. And Alonso had this opportunity to move first, went for the slick tyres instead of the intermediates. This was sort of the pivot point of the race, I suppose, or the major talking point of the Grand Prix. I mean, let's just start with the basics of this one. What did you think of the decision as the rain fell that Alonso moved to slicks instead of intermediates, when on that same lap, admittedly, of course, behind him, several drivers were already preparing to move onto that wet weather tyre?
The really interesting thing about that was that there was a difference between how I interpreted it live and what Aston Martin were actually doing, because I looked at it and thought, okay, you've looked at this. Obviously, Alonso had the gauge of what the track was like. Quite a lot of it was dry at that point, but where it was wet, it was really, really problematic and getting worse. So I thought what they were doing is they were thinking, well, look behind, there's no real threats. If we have to come in again for inters, we don't lose anything, but we might just gain something here, because I felt that inters were the tyre of choice, because that's what everyone was going to. So they probably thought, well, Verstappen's going to go to inters. And by putting on the mediums, I thought you're giving yourself an opportunity there, because sometimes you get a bit of rain in, survive a couple of laps with a bit of low grip, and then you're on the right tyre again and Verstappen has to make another stop. Bingo, you've won the race. The interesting thing was, when we spoke to Mike Crack after, and you were there, weren't you, in the pit lane when we spoke to him after, he basically explained, no, that we just thought this was the right tyre. We just thought the conditions were right for it. So for them, that was the kind of standard tyre choice, which is odd because it wasn't the standard tyre choice for anyone else. So I interpreted it as a quite a neat little gamble. They didn't. And of course, the interesting thing was, had they gone to Inters with that one lap undercut, because it was getting worse, they would have actually taken a chunk of time out of Verstappen. I think if you look at the numbers, I don't think he'd have come out ahead, Alonso, or I don't think Verstappen would have dropped behind. He'd have lost quite a lot of time with that lap, but I don't think there was enough. Red Bull themselves said they probably had 3 or 4 seconds in hand. And also they could have given Verstappen the hurry up. It's like, right, if it's going to get tight, we'll let you know if it's a bit critical on the in-lap with the closing rate of Alonso. So it was an interesting one, although it's strangely one of those times where actually doing the obvious thing was the more aggressive that might have paid off. Because you never know. You ideally want to make the right strategy, because you're saying, right, let's say there'll be 3 or 4 seconds margin. Well, 3 or 4 seconds margin, you can have a 6 second pit stop. You can have a unexpected mistake. You can encounter a back marker or some incident or something. So that would have been better, but I see to an extent why they did it, but they were very uncertain because Alonso said, well, it's Inters in a few bits, but it's dry everywhere else. I don't really know. In the pit lane, it was dry. It wasn't raining there. So they made that call. I know there was some criticism of it, but I didn't have a big problem with it, really. You have a go, and if the rain had suddenly abated, which it could have done, then potentially they could have won and it would have been an inspired call. So it was quite low downside in that respect. You weren't going to lose anything. The worst you would do by going slicks rather than onto the Inters was you'd lose an opportunity to be closer to Verstappen, which could have been interesting because Alonso was quick on intermediate, certainly quicker than Verstappen. But then again, Verstappen had a big advantage, so he'd have probably driven a bit quicker if he had Alonso getting dangerously close. So it's an interesting little example of how strategy can't be clear cut, and sometimes something that seems obvious or not obvious isn't obvious to the team. Shows how tough it is.
Yeah, and I think it is. I mean, sometimes strategists do deserve some criticism, although it's always easy to say that sitting in a chair in front of a computer recording a podcast. But it is particularly difficult in this situation, because I did like what Mike Crack said afterwards in the debrief, which was essentially that you just have to make a decision and then execute it. And ultimately, a decision is better than... I mean, often you do say in these conditions, to be fair, that you want to hang around as long as you can and then be certain. But in that situation where Verstappen wasn't pitting and they had an opportunity, they made a decision and executed. What I think is interesting here, though, is that no matter the tyre choice they made, it seemed like the risk was pretty low that they would drop lower than second. Ocon was so far behind them. And even they said as ultimately happened, stopping onto the mediums, they'd still be able to stop onto Inters a lap later and hold that position and consolidate second, and that would be it. I just can't help but wonder what the thinking was, considering that the entire strategy up to that point, before the rain arrived, was set up to capitalize on a situation like this. And yeah, I mean, you're right to say that ultimately the tyre potentially could have been the winner, depending on what the weather did, and they were uncertain. But the Inter just felt like the more aggressive one. And considering how much Fernando Alonso talked about the aggressive posture of the team in this race, that felt like a bit of a missed opportunity, regardless of what the result would have been. The missed opportunity just to see that strategy through to the conclusion. But I don't know, maybe that's too harsh.
Yeah, I guess the aggression that would be in that would be the fact you're doing it first. Mm. You're making the first move. I feel like the Inter was kind of it seemed to me to be the logical tie, but I was just in the media center. I didn't have full view of the weather and how it was on track, so that was a limited view from myself as well. But yeah, you're right, it is slightly strange that would have been a scenario you'd have thought, well, this could pay for us. Although in that scenario, the ideal way that would have manifested itself is Verstappen would have pitted on lap 44 because he'd run out of tyres, and then you're home free. But Verstappen's always going to extend. So yeah, I think it's why I think they were being honest when they said, actually, we just thought that was the right tyre to go on to slicks, which actually was not the right choice, and pretty much nobody else was doing that. So, yeah, it is strange when you have a strategy that's set up for that to then do that. I mean, there's other examples who are more extreme, like when you look at what Ferrari were doing, particularly with Leclerc, because, well, Leclerc and Sainz, they left them out there when they didn't need to, and you sort of thought, well, you've not really made this one pay off. And it's strange when you get those kind of judgments. And likewise, I don't know, jumping to a topic we want to talk about, when you had Pierre Gasly, he got to lap 47 on the mediums. Now that's very close to the rain. And okay, we had the usual F1 thing of, oh, it's going to rain on lap 35. And of course it doesn't. And we've had so many races where drivers have been told it will rain at this exact moment. And of course it doesn't. But AlphaTauri knew the rain. AlphaTauri, I've gone back to last year with Pierre Gasly. Mm-hmm. Alpine knew that the rain was coming. And Gasly claims, I've been trying to get the onboard to work so I can watch exactly what his feedback was. He said he wanted to stay out and extend because if he'd gone a few laps longer, that would have been a huge gain for him. And then it would have been Alpine third and fourth happy days. So, yeah, by definition, the Aston Martin decision with Alonso was odd because nobody else did it. And when you do the only decision no one else does, then that is by definition odd. And because Alonso couldn't give a fair guide to it on the pit wall, they couldn't be sure. And it's tough around there because you're on the coast. You never really know what rain's going to properly set in. So, yeah, it becomes very, very difficult. I think the positive thing for them is they were in that position not to lose out. I was, however, surprised they didn't see the slicks as a bit more risky because maybe you want to stay out. Mm-hmm. Because you know you're going to have with some water around a difficult lap on slick. So maybe in that situation, if you think slicks are the right one, do you extend a little bit more because you might have a little bit more tyre life or whatever. So yeah, a very odd little scenario to come up on. And of course, you've got to remember there's also the question of traffic as well. There are quite a lot of lap cars around. So you've got to factor in not just the gap behind you, but also the kind of interlopers in that gap. So yeah, a lot of factors to consider there. And I think Aston Martin will look at that and think, actually, we need to make sure on another occasion that we don't make a call like this and think that the tyre that no one else thinks is right is the right one. Because that was sort of a mistake, an understandable mistake, but you look at it and you think, actually, there's something we could improve from there and learn from.
Yeah, and also antithetical though it might be to a podcast like this, sometimes there is just a bit of luck involved. You know, the rain being 30 seconds earlier, had the race started 30 seconds later, had the pace been 30 seconds slower in general, there probably would have been enough rain that the decision would have been made clear. It just so happens Alonso was on the track having to make the decision at exactly the level of wetness, and it wasn't quite as clear as it was. But that's sometimes it. They still scored second, best result of the year so far. The search for that victory continues. I want to complete the podium now and talk about Esteban Ocon, who finished third. Despite many challenges that I think in some instances may have even gone a little bit under the radar, putting aside even the fact that he, well, technically qualified fourth and then Charles Leclerc was penalised backwards. Several drivers at several points through the race really thought they should have finished third. One of them was Carlos Sainz, who was behind him for, well, pretty much the entire first stint. Looked like the faster car. Ocon was kind of bottling up the midfield. He was trying to extend, he said, anyway, so maybe it's impossible to say exactly what the pace difference would have been. But they were on essentially the Verstappen-Alonso strategy. If you like, Ocon on mediums, Sainz on hards. Ocon pitted in response to Hamilton pitting behind. Sainz then also pitted in response to Hamilton, despite it being relatively early in the scheme of that hard tyre. Is this just another... Are we just going to start talking about Ferrari unusual decisions at this point in time? Or was there a logic to Ferrari deciding it was worth consolidating ahead of Hamilton rather than seeing if they could actually get ahead of Ocon here with a longer stint?
It does seem to indicate a certain mentality in that they were more worried about Hamilton and consolidating that than jumping the clearly slower car ahead. That's what got Sainz so worked up, because he felt it wasn't good, because as soon as Ocon had pitted, he felt he had the pace to maybe have overcut him. And there was also the possibility of rain, which people were at that point talking about. So at that point in the race, when you think rain's coming, if you've not stopped and you're running the hards, you're thinking, this is an interesting little scenario here for us. So yeah, it was very bizarre, and Sainz was very forthright over the radio. It wasn't just, I disagree with this. It had a heavy air of exasperation, didn't it? It's like, I can't believe this is happening to us again. So yeah, there was an opportunity to jump to third. Obviously, he'd been pretty aggressive. He'd hit Ocon once when he launched that ludicrously optimistic move and actually did slightly damage the back of Ocon's car. I did have a look at it in Parc Fermé. There was a bit of damage to sort of the wall of the diffuser. Nothing that really made a huge difference in terms of performance. Would have done if you were driving around Barcelona aero-wise, but yeah, he was lucky to get away with that. He had the front wing damage. So yeah, it seemed to me that Sainz was proactively trying to go forward and the others were looking at the threats from behind. And yeah, there's a certain logic in that, because Monaco is normally a race that's dictated by the gaps behind you and who can find the undercut. You've got to strangle the undercut's opportunities. Fine. But then you've got overcut opportunities as well sometimes when there's a slower car. So I thought that was a little bit flat-footed, and I thought even the when they went onto wets, intermediates later on, they were a little bit flat-footed as well, which Sainz would probably agree with, given he had that that quick spin. So, yeah, that turned a potential third into eighth. And, yeah, I get why Sainz was so frustrated. I'd like to have seen Ferrari be a little bit more attacking there rather than just holding their place in the queue, which was ultimately, that was Ocon's strategy, is hold your place in the queue. There's no one ahead for you to attack. So that's what dictates your strategy. But when you're a cracker car, you will be thinking about ways to take advantage of this situation.
Yeah, and both him and Leclerc finished behind both Mercedes cars in the end because they delayed that stop to intermediates until lap 55. By lap 54, it was fairly clear it was wet. You can say maybe if the radar looked like the rain was going to ease quickly, you kind of tough it out. But at that point, it seemed like the race was going in one direction. So that was how Sainz was eliminated for the battle for third. Pierre Gasly, though, was... there's a great, actually, photo of the team celebrations afterwards in which Gasly, Ocon and Laurent Rossi, who we might use as context here, were all celebrating. Gasly celebrating the least amount of all of them. Clearly, was a little bit unhappy that he didn't have the opportunity to go straight from hards, which he started on, to intermediates because he stopped on lap 47, agonizingly close to the arrival of the rain. Another situation similar to the Ferrari call, in which it seems like only a couple of laps you could have extended and made it there. I thought it was interesting, though, this was a good result for Alpine. Third, obviously, is even Gasly scoring pretty heavy points, more points than you would had all of the front-running teams been fully in contention. But is it too harsh to say that maybe this was another situation in which that execution that Laurent Rossi was so critical of only a couple of weeks ago could really just have been cleaner? Or is this a situation in which Alpine really was just focused on Ocon, knowing that a podium result is a bigger statement than, say, a fourth and a fifth?
Yeah, I think they probably could have been a bit more positive with this one and seen an opportunity. I don't know if they wanted to make sure that they had one car out of sync with the other so they could, but they put them on the same lap anyway later for intermediate. So I don't really see why they did that. Whether they just missed the fact that they could make so many gains. But yeah, there was this chance for anybody who started hard and had not pitted when the rain came mm-hmm. was on the ideal strategy because that gained you positions. And that's what obviously briefly put George Russell up in third place ahead of Ocon as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it just seemed like a little bit flat-footed. And obviously, yeah, great result. Seventh place, backing up the third place. Lots of points for Alpine. 21 points they'd have got out of that. Reasserted themselves properly as the best of the midfield. But yeah, there was a chance there for Alpine to be third and fourth. And when you're talking about execution, you think opportunity. Okay, why did we not go for that opportunity? Did they miss it? Was Gasly not giving the right feedback? It just seemed like a chance to do a little bit more, which they will probably rue a bit, but they can equally, at least on a day when things aren't done optimally, they're finishing third and seventh. There's worse outcomes than that, particularly in that team's recent past.
Yes, they've experienced all of the worst outcomes pretty much, I think it's fair to say. And finally, you mentioned him there, it was George Russell who had a golden opportunity really to take third place. He was on the optimum strategy, hard straight into intermediates. No consideration, no thinking about it, went straight there, promoted straight to third from further down the order, but unfortunately made a mistake on his outlap when it was still pretty wet and pretty chaotic and drivers were all over the place and lost two places on the spot, which enabled Ocon to get there. But it was pretty well executed for Mercedes considering this was a somewhat high-pressure weekend for them with all of their upgrades, and in the end walked away possibly with more points than they could have expected considering the pure pace of the car, although Spain is going to be the bigger call for them when they can really stretch the legs of that machine. An interesting race in Monaco in the end. Qualifying was still better, but I don't think that's such a bad thing. I think the race at least we got was interesting, and it wasn't such a dud race for you to come back onto the podcast yet. I'm very pleased about that most of all.
Yeah, it's always a shame when Monaco's just a complete procession, but mm-hmm. it's one of those venues, isn't it? It does throw up those interesting races, and this one's actually particularly good because there were so many what ifs. It's strange in that you had that rain coming and it gave the whole field an almighty shake, but then when you actually looked at the effect of that shake, it only moved a few people around. I think we had 9 of the same 10 point scorers we would have done had the race just played out normally. It was only Tsunoda who dropped back out of the points with Piastri getting in, I think, if memory serves. So yeah, one of those funny ones, but it does create all of those tantalizing alternative routes. And the fact that you had this battle at the front and then that battle for third with multiple drivers who could have been there, not to mention Sergio Perez, who eliminated himself from podium competition the previous day. So yeah, an interesting little race, and I feel less hard done by having to do Monaco now on this podcast.
Thanks so much for joining me, Ian.
That's great. Thanks very much for having me.
Aston Martin is satisfied to have secured second in Monte Carlo, but surely once the dust settles, the team will reflect that a slightly more aggressive approach to the race could have paid big dividends. Still, it was a strong result for the nascent team in a year no one really has an answer to Red Bull Racing. Thanks very much to Ed Straw for joining me. You can subscribe to The Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a rating and a review to help spread the word. You can also find us on social media. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. Special thanks to Ben Loke from Bloke Designs for the show artwork, and our theme music is by Simon Hosford. My name's Michael Aminato, and I'll catch you next week for the Spanish Grand Prix.
Get ready, race fans, because the ultimate NASCAR experience is about to hit the airwaves. Welcome to Pit Pass NASCAR, the podcast that takes you deep into the heart-pounding world of NASCAR racing.
Join us each week as we bring you closer to the NASCAR action with exclusive interviews and all the news and rumors you need with your favorite drivers, team members, and industry insiders.
So whether you're a fan of super speedways, short ovals, or road racing, or you've just watched Talladega Nights, Pit Pass NASCAR is the podcast you've been waiting for.
Get ready to fuel your passion for NASCAR like never before. Subscribe now to Pit Pass NASCAR on your favorite podcast platform, or head to evergreenpodcast.com and get ready to join us.
Launching in the fall on Evergreen Podcast Network. Follow us on social media at pitpass_NASCAR to stay up to date with everything you need to know about the podcast.